Welcome to the Author to Author podcast. I am your host, Pamela R. Haynes, multi-award-winning author of Loving the Brothers and Loving the Sisters. I had an amazing weekend. I was nominated for a National Diversity Award, and when voting opened, I received a phenomenal 88 votes. I reached out to family, friends and colleagues near and far, and I'm delighted to let you know the number increased, reaching 140 votes. I am overwhelmed by the overnight response and humbled by the best wishes I have received. Thank you to my community, my listeners, DJs and station managers for your love and support. I appreciate every vote. I will, of course, keep you posted if I get through to the next round. Follow me on Instagram at LovingTheAuthor to track and keep up with my progress. We are moving full steam ahead with preparations for the Newham Word Festival on Friday, the 30th of June 2023. I will be interviewed as part of the festival in an event called An Evening with Pamela R. Haynes. So for those of you in the UK, save the date and again, follow me on Insta for more information. Lastly, my books are being read in Gambia. I received a photo from a friend who is looking forward to reading the books on her holidays. Well, enough about me. Can you believe we're halfway through the season already? Well, today's guest is Emma Cunningham, lecturer at the University of East London, and she talks about her new academic book, Women in Policing. Let's dive into her book now. See you on the other side. Hello there, Emma. Thank you for joining me on the Author to Author podcast. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for asking, Pam.
We've been trying to have this interview for quite some time since I met you, which I believe was about 18 months ago.
Yeah, the time's just flown by.
Yes, it has. Yes, yes. So I'm glad to finally have a window with you and have this episode with you now. So thank you for joining me. And also thank you for sending me a copy of your book, Women in Policing. It's my second academic book, so I'm really pleased that we can showcase authors of different genres as well, not just fiction, but we've had children authors, we've had self-help books, we've had devotionals and memoirs. So it's good to have you as part of season 5 as well. But before we launch into the interview about your book, please tell us where you're from, where you're based now, and in terms of heritage, what country do you claim?
So I am based in the northeast of England, and I work at the University of East London. So I do a fair bit of travelling each week for classes and meetings and things like that. But for the most part, I'm based in the northeast. And I've lived in England for most of my life. I had a few years when I lived in Germany as a young child. And my heritage is mixed, but not fully known. So I'm part British and part mixed. That's who I am and where I am and where I live. That's as far as I know. So that has been a journey in itself, but I think that could be another chat just on searching out heritage and where I've been and how I've been trying to do that.
Okay, no problem. We'll have to, when you write that book, then come back on to the Author to Author podcast. Let's launch into the book then. I really wanted to know why you decided to join the police force.
So I wanted to just research into how the police did their job and how women in policing kept doing the job that they did really, really well, even in the most challenging of circumstances. So it was really initially about just hearing from them what their own lived experiences were of policing and what they liked about it and what the challenges were.
But you yourself was a serving police officer, wasn't you?
No, I've never been in the police, only ever
Right.
researched policing and policing issues. So, yeah, I did do some teaching in policing. So, I've taught police officers as well as undergraduates, and some in Rwanda, in Africa, and in a couple of different places in England. But, yeah, never been in policing myself. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I got that completely wrong. So let's go back then. What was your very first career? What was that about?
So my first career, I mean, my first degree was in politics, but I am a nice person, honestly. And then from that, I started teaching and did a master's. I had two young children at that time, so I was very busy and started doing a PhD and started doing some research jobs and some teaching jobs, really. And then got the job in academia and worked there. And I've worked in academia since probably for the last 25 years now. So that's quite a lot of my career has been in academia. And quite a bit of that has been involved in looking at issues around really equality, diversity, and inclusion. And they've been the main principles in terms of what I'm interested in looking at in terms of my research as well. So they've been the guiding principles, really.
Oh wow. So the bulk of your career has been doing exactly what you're doing now in terms of being in academia and research, and hence the book W Women in Policing. What was it about that subject that you wanted to research?
So I was just genuinely interested in speaking to different women of different backgrounds and different experiences, really, and just sharing that lived experience of what it's like policing and why they loved it. And the one thing the 23 women that I spoke to in the first piece of published research, in the first journal article, told me was that they all loved policing. And even though they'd had difficult experiences in their job, they were still very committed to making a difference in terms of justice. And every day was a different day, so you could never have the same day twice. And you never knew what was coming up, and that they loved all of that as well, which was quite different from my own experience of life. And I think that kind of experience would make me worry, not knowing what was coming up next, not knowing what I had planned. But they all loved their job and they all felt like they'd made a difference. And I think that was the one kind of unifying thought that they gave us as researchers in terms of summing up their sometimes, 40 years in the police, some had
Oh,
two
wow.
years. Police, the mixture of women were different, but the mixture of the lengths of service were different too.
So, when you're researching, how did you find these women in the first place?
This was via a snowballing strategy. So we had links with a couple of police force areas because we'd worked with them before, and therefore we contacted a few women in those areas to see if they would be happy to maybe do a survey or have a face-to-face interview. And in the end, we ended up getting 23 women from all over the country who we went and did face-to-face interviews with.
Were there concerns about taking part in this kind of research?
Yes, I think there were. I think some of the women were possibly a little bit concerned in case we did anything that would make their involvement public. So, for instance, we had to say that we would keep everything anonymized so that people would not know who it was who'd given us the data that they'd given us and the experiences that they'd given us. So, we just had to reassure that we were taking those ethical considerations into account while sharing their lived experiences of policing, which is what we would have done anyway. So as university lecturers and researchers, we have to abide by an ethical standard. And when we're doing a piece of research, that has to all be cleared through our ethical processes at the university.
Yes, I remember that. I think it's when you're doing research methods and you then submit what it is that you want to do, and it has to go for a panel, from what I can recall, and they come back with issues that you need to be aware of when you're conducting that kind of research. So I certainly relate to that. But this would have been at a really high level, at PhD level, that you were studying for at the time. What were the other challenges that you had in terms of getting your data together?
In terms of the women who I spoke to, I couldn't get a diversity of different women from different ethnicities. So that was one of the drawbacks of my data group, in terms of getting lived experiences from different women. So from Asian and Black women, for instance, which was another area that I wanted to research. So I am still doing that, and that will come out, but that'll be in papers, I think. And I have got those connections since coming to work in London and to work with a much more diverse group of people. So that was one of the challenges, and there have been several.
Can you tell me, were the concerns from the women to do with the community that they were serving, or was it more to do with the establishment and the running of their particular police force?
Yeah, so I would say genuinely it was more to do with the establishment and, well, sometimes their bosses and sometimes their peers. So I think at times they were treated quite badly, given the kind of role that policing is and the kind of jobs that they had to turn up to and do kind of on a daily basis. Yeah, I think they were treated badly in a variety of different ways, and they had examples of those things that they could share with us and illustrate how hard that was for them to take on board.
What was their experiences of recruitment and training?
For some of the women, they'd joined at a time the full inclusion of women in policing. So they still had the WPC, so the Women's Police Constable epaulettes. And that, for instance, was used by one of their bosses when he'd said to one of the women who explained to us that she got asked to go into the office and was told by her supervisor that, look, you've had your hair cut short, you've lost your W off your WPC, and you're wearing a man's tie. Are you a lesbian? So that was quite an illustrative example of the way in which, for instance, the police uniform can be seen as kind of, or was used as a kind of illustration of someone's sexuality in policing. And I think that just illustrates that kind of policing background, really, and the police culture at times.
Yes, because you always got the impression that it would have been hard to recruit women in the first place into that kind of environment. And also in terms of the training, those kind of attitudes can then be reinforced. All the isms get played out at training college. Was that the kind of thing the women were coming back and telling you?
So some of the women had had experiences of going away to college, to the police training, Hendon, for instance, and others like that. But others, more recent joiners, had gone through the university systems where they'd had to go and do part of the training at the universities, as well as going into policing practice. So there was a mixture, yeah. But I think where there was that separation and all the police together at those police academies, there were a huge build-up of problems at times.
How were you able to galvanize the women to support one another, to tell their stories?
So yeah, they were quite open and they were very frank, about some of the examples that I've used in the book. And they were really, really amenable to sharing their experiences. So some of them would say, when they'd started in policing, they'd worn the old-fashioned pencil skirts, they'd had a stocking allowance, they had a very small truncheon that they were allowed to carry in their police handbag, and they had a kind of like air hostess police hat. But then they also said that trying to police in that uniform was particularly challenging. So if they were having to run after someone, for instance, they'd have to hitch their skirt up so that they could actually run, because otherwise they wouldn't have been able to run after anyone. And there were concerns about their well-being and about whether, as women, they would be strong enough to do that job. And they have shown over that period of time that they have done that job and they've done it really, really well. They were excellent in terms of participating in the research. Yeah.
And what do they make of your book?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what they'll make of the actual book because their part of that research was just one chapter of that book. The other big piece of research within that book was looking at police disciplinary records. And that was something that I did using freedom of information requests to three different police force areas. And I really just wondered, given my interest in policing and women within the police and what they'd had to face in terms of the challenges, I wondered whether they would be involved in similar misdemeanors or misdeeds or offences as their male colleagues would. And I wanted to look at that. So I thought by looking at the data over a period of 5 years, I could maybe see whether that was the case or not, whether they committed the same crimes or whether there were any differences and what that might mean.
And was there any differences?
There were differences. So there were similarities as well. So some of the similarities included things like car offences, speeding, driving, motoring, those kinds of offences were kind of shared offences. And there was an instance in that 5 year data of the worst offence, which was a death in custody. And that was involved a policewoman and a policeman who were involved in that case. So in terms of the disciplinary records, they were the ones that stand out. In terms of differences, I did see quite a big difference in terms of the types of offences. So, in terms of policemen being involved in relationships with vulnerable victims and things like domestic violence and also harassment, and women police officers weren't involved in any of those over that period that I was looking at.
Up until this evening, I was watching the news just before our interview, and again, the Metropolitan Police are back in the news again for their use of or misuse of WhatsApp and WhatsApp messages. From what I've understood, there's only been one woman prosecuted in relation to messages she left in a WhatsApp group, but the majority are men. One of the excuses used was that, this dark sense of humor that police officers have because of what they face on the streets every day. Do you have a view?
I think they do see a lot of darkness and they see a lot of things that they can't then unsee. And I think it's a lot of the kinds of things that the ordinary public would never wish to be involved in knowing about, let alone seeing. However, I don't think that can be used as a justification for the kinds of things that we saw in the WhatsApp at Charing Cross, and the kind of misogyny and racism and just the belittling of other people, of different kinds of people who are not seen as good as or the same as them. And I think that's a massive, massive cultural problem in policing. And I don't think it's easy to say, but I don't think we can explain it as kind of a side effect of having to face some horrific issues.
I mean, yes, I mean, it's fair to say that there are just some communities that will never trust the police because of their experiences at the hands of the police. And the example I'm thinking of is that a black man recently went to Amsterdam. So it's not just a UK problem, it's,
No.
a wider issue. And to be stopped 3 times within 5 minutes of each other on the same stretch of road, clearly signaling to him that he was not welcomed in the country and couldn't wait to get back to the United Kingdom. What do you think needs to happen at each point for women to feel as though this is a career that I want to apply for? I want to serve my community. I want to progress within my community, within the police. What do you think needs to happen so that people feel as though that they can work? They're almost fighting two jobs. They're fighting crime and fighting their colleagues as well. So what needs to happen for everyone to be on the same page?
Yeah, I think there's got to be some massive changes in terms of policing culture. There's got to be an acceptance that there has been racism, there has been sexism, and this racism and misogyny cannot be allowed to just develop and become worse, as it seems to be doing on different platforms as they are emerging. So I think a big change is necessary in overhauling. And I think until we accept that there is this institutional problem of racism and sexism, misogyny, ableism, all of those issues need to be tackled and exposed, and hands need to be held up, because unless that happens, I can't see real change taking place. And I think there'll just be a tweak around the edges and then a backlash against that, which isn't going to be helpful. So I think it's got to be a thorough and challenging cultural change in policing.
And I suppose women and black people need to feel when they tell their stories are believed and that someone is going to take this up on their behalf and take what they're saying seriously. For any change to occur, you have to speak about it and speak on it before things start to change. Otherwise, you will always have this status quo where people do not feel able to whistleblow. People do not feel able to offer any counseling afterwards. Very often, you hear it's the whistleblower that's had to leave and to resign or got the sack or investigated. So, someone makes a complaint and they end up being the ones who are investigated over the most minor things, rather than someone saying, you know what, I'm going to look into it and I'm going to come back to you with my findings. That needs to happen.
I think it does. And one of the things that I am interested in doing and trying to do in my work at UEL, because a lot of my students are those students who have been stopped and searched and will come in and tell us that that is what has happened to them. They'll disclose that to us. And I've been making links with police and have set up a meeting with City of London Police, who are going to allow some of our students who want to scrutinise some of the stop and search police body cam data, and to give their feedback and critique of that, and to give their perspective on how that feels for that person to have been stopped in that way. And I think that is one of the things that can be done. Those links can be made across education and institutions like policing, with me as a bit of a conduit, really, taking my students, allowing them to have a voice and to feel empowered enough as a focus group to give their comments to the police, and for the police to have to act on some of that feedback that they're going to get. So that's one of the things that I'm hoping I can do in terms of trying to address some of those issues that we see from our students' perspectives on a daily basis.
So, when did you take up your post with UEL?
So I took up the post in September 2021.
What courses do you teach?
So I teach crime and criminal justice, the degree programme, and at the moment the teaching that I'm doing has been on leadership skills for criminal justice, the dissertation module, and also this semester I'm doing a module called Mentally Disordered Offenders. So we've
Yes.
been to Bedlam today in Kent. So we've just been to the hospital that was Asylum with students today as a trip for them to kind of bring that reality around identity and treatment or punishment and those kinds of issues around mental health and victims and offenders.
I was a probation service officer at the time when we had care in the community. And
Yes.
I don't know if you recall, one of the offenders stabbed a member of the public at the train station. Unfortunately for us, his wife was working in our office at the time as a student. So
Wow.
we immediately felt the fallout of his murder and all the subsequent stuff that happened in terms of the poor care that the man received and things that were missed that then led to the decision to release him. And he murdered a member of the public on the day of his release, clearly very, very unwell and very sick. I think it's important that students get that reality check in terms of being able to visit institutions like that, being part of focus groups with the police as well, because they are very much at the brunt of when it goes wrong. I commend the work that you're doing at UEL around those issues. It was a wonderful experience coming up to UEL and especially sitting in the courtroom. Which I take it is a building where it's a simulation, isn't it? All the benches are there, the bits where the magistrates sit, the press, and members of the public. How have you been able to utilize that facility to prepare the students you're working with?
In terms of using that space, we've had students come in, and when they came in from the summer break, so in September, October, when we got back together, we did a kind of simulation for stop and search. So there was a victim and police officer. So the person who was stopped was in the motorized wheelchair and she was stopped and searched. But then there were also law students there who were talking about why that was done in the way that it was undertaken. There were police students there talking about what their duty was and what the legislation was. And there were crim students there talking about the impact of that socially on communities, for instance, and on certain groups of people. So, in that sense, it was a hands-on kind of issue that everyone had something to say about, so each person could easily add to the debate and the discussion about policing today.
Yeah, I mean, I cannot stress enough that whilst it's good to know the law and have a theoretical framework, nothing beats being able to practice in the setting Because I do remember going to Snaresbrook Crown Court to observe. I'd just started in the probation service, and I went with a man who was a student, an MA student, and I could follow the proceedings because I had previously worked for the CPS. And I knew that as soon as our colleague stepped outside, I knew the judge was going to ask a question and question the probation service. So when he did, I looked at my MA student to, well, you're more qualified than me. And he was mortified. It's like the blood had drained from his face and pooled at his feet. So I just stood up and said, we're just observing today, but I can go and fetch the probation officer. And he said, no, thank you. I'll send one of the ushers to do that. In terms of having that practice of being in court and knowing how to give evidence and who to address your comments to when you're being asked a question, all of these are soft skills that can be missed. So it's good to have that kind of space where you can have that kind of practice and make errors, and then you know for next time or in real life what you should be doing.
And I think it is a daunting position to be in. If you've never been in a courtroom before, it's a really daunting, unfamiliar room to be in that can just totally put you off your stride if you're not used to being in such a formal setting with very formalized language. And, the whole thing about it is to copy what a courtroom looks like so that students do get that chance to participate in that.
How long is the course for?
It's 3 years. So the degree course is a 3-year course that students do full time.
And
So
are you taking students from 18, or do you have a more mature cohort?
both. So I have students currently who are 18, but I also have a lot of students who have to work as well as study. I have students who work, study, have children. So they are juggling a lot of stuff, but they are doing it and they are successful and they've got high aims that they want to achieve certain things and they've got hopes for what they want to do at the end of their degree programs.
So,
So
are you attracting people from the local community?
we are trying to attract students from the local community. And actually, I think UEL does attract students from around, well, from the Newham area. And we are trying to build up community links. As I said, with the police, for instance, we've had yourself in, so former probation worker, giving your lived experience and talking about some of the issues that are pertinent to their lives in that area. So those kinds of things, I think, help students to look at where they're living and how those issues impact on them. And so we are trying to develop things like research into Newham, so crime stats and things like policing in that area, also things like educational achievements, poverty indices of inequalities, those kinds of things, and look at them in terms of not just research, but actually the kind of community issues that might be at play in Newham, and hopefully getting some more links to other parties in the community who would be happy to come into UEL as well, speak to our students and, give them some insight into their own professional experience.
Because it's you're situated, especially in Stratford campus, in at the buzz and the heart of everything. You've got Old Stratford Town on one side, you've got Westfield Shopping Centre on the other side, which will have its own issues within itself around crime and so on. And in the beginning, I didn't think people were quite welcomed to, they expected that the locals would stay in Stratford Town shopping centre, and the more affluent people would go up to Westfield. But there's been quite a mixture of people, not just from Newham, but from the surrounding boroughs, who come into Stratford as well. And it could be really a busy place in the evenings as well. But from someone who has lived in England or the up the country. What has it been like working and living in London?
I've really enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed being in Stratford. I didn't know what to expect, to be honest, because when you go to City of London, it's a totally different vibe. I found Stratford to be a very friendly place, a much friendlier place than I'd expected. So I didn't expect in London for shopkeepers to speak to you and pass the time of day and have a bit of chit chat, or, all the different people in different sectors speaking to you and from different backgrounds. Yeah, I didn't expect that. Very
That's good
friendly.
to hear. Newham in particular can get a reputation that it doesn't deserve. People only see a town with urban issues, as they call them, with poverty. The term I hate is economically deprived area. And these things may be true, but when you're living here, you choose to live here. A lot of people have now moved into Newham because the house prices are more favorable. We're getting a more mixture of people. So it's really good to hear that when outsiders come into Newham, that they're having good interactions and that they feel quite safe, and they feel welcomed as well. So that's really good to hear that. My next question is, where do you see yourself 5 years from now?
Oh, wow. Well, that will bring me up to 61, I think. So maybe not working as hectically as I currently feel like I am sometimes. I do love my job, so I still like it. And I still will be doing some reading, research, whatever, I hope, but less full on, full time. So a little bit more relaxed, hopefully. Still interested in those same issues. So the same guiding principles that I've always been interested in, I will follow, whether it's in policing, whether it's in communities, however that comes up. So, yeah, I'd like to think that I'll still be doing something that I'm enjoying.
Well, I have a confession to make. I think the last time we met, I shared that I was learning Spanish and
That's
I was doing the Duolingo program. But my husband said, Pam, I've noticed you're not practicing anymore. And the reason is I found it too competitive. I'm now in these leagues and you have to stay in the top three to stay in the league. And it just got too much. I felt like, oh my gosh, the time. I need to do a lesson before midnight. Otherwise, I'm going to be relegated down a league. But you were learning to speak Spanish, and are you still continuing to learn?
I was on Duolingo the same as you, but I just felt like I didn't have the time to devote to it in the same way. And it did start to get to that level where if you hadn't done it, you were sent so many emails about the things you haven't done that day. And you don't need that on top of your work and the rest of your life that you're trying to juggle like everyone else's. Some things will fall some days. If I can do it again, but without getting to that point where it's going to be a chore, then yeah, I'd definitely still like to do it. I definitely want to speak Spanish, so I need to do it. But whether it's with Duolingo or some other version, I don't know.
I think I would right now benefit from maybe being around Spanish people or a class or an evening that you can go to where everyone just speaks Spanish throughout. I think that would be more beneficial than feeling that I have to be doing these lessons.
And I think it's another thing on a tablet or a phone or a laptop. And you think when you've worked on that all day, you don't really want to do that again on a night. So something else, something more interactive
So,
would be beneficial.
when you're not learning Spanish, researching, writing books, doing papers, I've seen a few articles,
Oh,
and
yes.
traveling up and down, what do you do to relax? What do you do to have fun?
So I like to walk. I like to walk. I live right on the northeast coast. So I've got the beach like 5 minutes from where I live, but it is brutally cold. So as long as you've wrapped up really, really warm, you're fine. It's still a nice feeling to walk down by the beach, I think, even in a cold area where I live. So I like to do all that. I like to see my friends, my family. I'm like a homey kind of person in that sense. So I love to see my kids and their partners and just everyone to get together. And that's what hopefully we'll be doing in a couple of weeks for birthdays and things. So I'm looking forward to that. And we'll all go over to Valencia as well and spend some time over there. So that's part of my main plan for the next few years, that we can enjoy time together where it's not expensive and it's a very simple kind of life. I think that's the way forward.
Oh, it sounds idyllic. Sounds idyllic. So we've come to the end of our interview. If people want to get hold of your book, Women in Policing, how do they do that?
It's still on sale with Routledge, and yeah, they can get it online. I think there's an online version as well, which is cheaper than a hardback book. But I would suggest dip into and out of things that are online rather than go out and buy a hardback book copy of it, unless you're particularly going to study in that area. My view would be to use bits and bobs of what's online that I've done that are free.
And if people are interested in maybe going on one of the courses at UEL, how would they do that?
Yeah, get in touch with us. So you can email us, you can drop in and see us. There are open days on the UEL website. So yeah, there are a number of ways you can get in touch, and we'd love to see you.
I know that some of the lecturers have been teaching remotely, but are there opportunities for students to work, do their course online?
It's not fully online anymore. I think it was only during COVID where it went to the full online situation. But one thing that we did learn during that period is it's good to have the recording of the lectures and things like that so that students, if they do miss a session, or even if they want to go back to that lecture and go through it again, they can do it because we've got the recordings of the lectures. I think that's one good thing that came out of that whole period, but mostly it's face-to-face classes.
Right. Okay. Now, before I go, I know that your daughter is also a published author. Do you want to quickly mention her name, her book, and how people can get hold of that?
Yeah, my daughter is currently writing the book, so she hasn't
All
written yet.
right.
But yeah, my daughter's Jess Martin, and she's at the University of Leeds. And she's working on a book that would be based on her PhD. So, yeah, it would be looking at things like austerity and the images from that period, really, in terms of media images. So, those kinds of issues would be the ones that she'd be looking at in her book. And that'll be with Bloomsbury Press when it does get released, when she finishes with.
Okay. We'll have to get her on the Author to Author podcast as well to
Oh,
tell us
she'd
about
love
her book.
that. She'd love it.
So thank you so much for your time and
Oh,
thank
thank
you for
you.
joining us. I wish you all the very best in the future.
Oh, thanks, Pam. Loved it. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Emma Cunningham as much as I enjoyed interviewing her. It's competition time now. Emma mentioned that her daughter is also writing a book. What is her daughter's name and what is her book going to be about? Taking part in the competitions couldn't be easier. Simply contact me on Instagram or Facebook with the correct answer by this coming Friday at 5 p.m. British Summer Time. That's all for now, folks. Have a wonderful week ahead, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.